by NSN 49 on Nantucket.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Hollywood is gearing up for its holiday season blockbusters, even as bombs fly and cinematic images of war dominate the news. Coming up, we'll look at the season's latest releases and ask if a new era makes us see them differently. But first, a second battle waits to be won in Afghanistan, this one on the humanitarian front. Right now, the lives of 6 million Afghans depend on whether food can reach them as winter sets in. I spoke with Dominic McSorley, emergency coordinator for the relief agency Concern Worldwide. I asked him if recent victories in Afghanistan are helping humanitarian efforts there.
Well, it's affecting us positively and negatively in a number of ways. Quite clearly now, with the resolution of the war campaign, areas are now opening up. We're getting more access to areas, to the population of 6 million that is food dependent and in need of food. So that's a positive. On the negative side, I think that there is a huge problem with lawlessness. There's still too many guns in the country, and there's a massive problem now with landmines. So many of the populations, it's very fluid. A lot of the people who had been displaced because of the war are trying to go home to rebuild their houses to have protection as the winter is coming, and the winter is there because snow is falling. And that's creating huge problems in terms of difficulties of accessing populations on the ground.
We've read stories of quite acute suffering and hunger in areas that have been liberated from the Taliban for weeks now. What's the problem with getting food into areas where the Taliban no longer rules?
As you know, I mean, the problem in Afghanistan has been compounded over the last couple of years, 3 years of successive drought, 20 years of war. And we're trying to address all of those problems in the last couple of weeks. Now, with the war going on after September the 11th, it's set back certainly the humanitarian operation substantially. And essentially, we were sitting around waiting for time to get in. I think what we're trying to do now is cram in as much as we can before winter. But logistically, it's not easy operating in that region. And now the Taliban areas, we can operate in those areas. Let's remember, there isn't a proper government in there. The political solution is just about happening, but it's not really happening fast enough in terms of our ability to deliver food aid.
As you say, the snow is already falling. Is there some portion of that 6 million people who is effectively already doomed to die?
We conducted a nutrition survey, which coincidentally finished on September the 10th, and that left a stark warning. It said if the aid agencies do not double and redouble their efforts now, 20% of the population that we surveyed, a population of 300,000, may die due to lack of food, lack of proper nutrition, and cold.
We've heard the political frustration, for example, in the north, the bridge coming in from Uzbekistan that would have allowed people all over the north around Mazar-i-Sharif to be fed has not been opened by the government of Uzbekistan. Do you feel that you're getting adequate support from the international community in bringing political leverage to bear and in terms of military support and escort to move the food where it's needed?
No, to be blunt, I don't think so. And I think that the offshoot of the war in Afghanistan is that the humanitarian operation was effectively sidelined. Now, I think that with a political solution coming in, all efforts must be made to put pressure on neighboring countries. I mean, we took weeks to get back into that country. We had to go to Tajikistan. We had to wait around for visas. It is not easy getting into Afghanistan. It is not easy getting out. I myself had to take a horse ride across the mountain for 7 hours. Pressure has to be put on to open up those channels now.
What portion of the relief community is even actually at work in Afghanistan? We read only yesterday that the United Nations is not in large portions of the country.
No, that's true, and certainly the aid agencies like Concern. We pulled our staff on September the 11th. We made a decision to go back in 2 weeks later. I went back in myself the day before the strike started. There was a lot of areas that you could have worked in. The UN operates on very kind of complex security guidelines, and that are influenced often by the politics.
Meaning they're waiting for a security clearance to go in for the safety of their workers, or is it something else?
It's largely for the safety of their workers, you know, but these are complex security guidelines and in some respects are really not that realistic. The reality is, without the UN in there, it's very difficult for us to operate. We need them in there to ensure that the World Food Programme trucks are getting in, that the UN flights are getting in. There are no banks in Afghanistan. How do we get money in? We have to get a flight in. There are no commercial flights. We are very dependent on the UN and having a presence in there.
You just returned from Afghanistan a week or so ago. Give us a sense of the difficulties you saw and experienced on the ground as a relief worker there.
There are so many stories. I mean, I travelled 700 kilometres on non-existent roads. Concern has been in there since 98. We're doing food for work. You know, this is not just handing out food. We're trying to get roads constructed so that we can open up villages. We're distributing food to a population of 250,000. It's a big programme. I was in a displaced camp about 2 weeks ago, and I met with a woman who was digging a hole in the ground so that her and her children could sleep there at night time, and she was pulling a piece of plastic sheeting over her. Now, that's what it comes down to. I mean, people were reduced to begging in villages, and that kind of story is repeated throughout the whole country. The perception, I suppose, is that the war is won, the problem solved. The problem is not solved.
Dominic, what were you hearing from the refugees themselves?
It depended. You know, for the staff, we have about 100 Afghani staff. We were largely working at that time in the Northern Alliance areas, and they were very supportive of the military campaign. Quite clearly, you know, it was what won them the victory and got them into Kabul. Story differs. You know, you go to a refugee camp in Pakistan, essentially, you know, I think people are thinking about going back. The Taliban is not there anymore. Women can go back, they can work, they can get their daughters educated, so they're positive. But the story is different if you go into a displaced camp where somebody doesn't have enough food. Their priority is food. It's not even the politics. They're not even aware of what the politics are going on. They're looking for food on a daily basis. So different stories, different perspectives.
Give us the bottom line. What's the number who may be at risk of death from starvation if the food doesn't get through soon?
Well, we have a population, and it's not just something that's pulled out of the air, but there are 6 million people dependent on food aid. And, you know, that's what it means. They depend on somebody else giving them food so that they can survive. I'm saying all 6 million are at risk. I'm not saying 6 million people will die. I mean, these are resourceful people. They've gone through a hell of a lot in the last 20 years. But certainly, when our estimate was that 20% of those could perish throughout the winter.
Dominic McSorley is Emergency Coordinator for Concern Worldwide. He spoke to us from Dublin. Just under a month ago, Bush administration strategist Karl Rove sat down with a slew of Hollywood movers and shakers and laid out the administration's wish list for this war-torn holiday season. He asked for films that show how America loves her troops, films that reveal the evil nature of the enemy, and films that tell America's kids that, hey, it'll be okay. But has Hollywood answered the call? Will it? We're looking at a new crop of films at the theaters and asking how they have or have not been respun for the current crisis. What do you think? Should Hollywood shift gears to respond to the war on terror? Have you noticed changes in the winter lineup? And what do you want to see, need to see, at the theater these days? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In the studio with us tonight, we have Garen Daly, our special coverage movie analyst and critic. Thanks for joining us, Garen Daly.
My pleasure.
And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Garen Daly, we're going to look at the films that are going to be coming out in this big film season. But first, take us back to that meeting in Hollywood, I guess at the Beverly Hills, the Peninsula Hotel, less than a month ago. Karl Rove, a lot of industry big shots. What was the message of the president's man to the silver screen honchos?
Well, you know, there's a lot that you have to look at it. This first, it's the first time that all the major heads of all the studios were together for the first time in about 35 years. So it was a major undertaking to get all these guys together. The fact that they wanted to be there and to be a part of what was going on is part of the patriotism that Hollywood is feeling right now. And they are feeling it just like the rest of the country. And what is coming out of this is an effort on both Washington's part and Los Angeles and Hollywood's part to come up with ways of making America seem better to the world. We're now looking at the images that we've been projecting out for years and saying, what has the impact been? And I think Hollywood's going to respond in some ways, but not in every single way. And I think one of the things that we have to take a look at, it's not just movies. I think one of the big shapers of how America is seen in the world is MTV. And I think MTV is going to be a crucial player in reshaping America's image to the world.
Oh, wait a minute. This is too much to take on. You're telling us that Hollywood and MTV are going to shake their booty less and put the big guns away? I mean, isn't that what made Hollywood rich and famous?
It is what made Hollywood rich and famous. They're not going to put it away, but I think that there's going to be a little more sensitivity, and I think that they're going to try and sell America to the world in a different way.
Jack Beattie, do you buy that? Can you imagine Hollywood signing up for that kind of regime in this kind of war?
Well, if they sense that that's what the public wants, they're going to deliver it. I mean, what some people could call patriotism is really just their sense of customers. There's this strong majoritarian support for the war. They don't want to cross that. But, you know, it's interesting, as someone pointed out in The Nation, just a few days, a few hours before this meeting, these same people, with the exception of ABC, refused to give Bush, President Bush,
oh, Jack, I think you've...
Afghanistan.
Oh, there you are.
So they actually, they I don't know if you heard that, but they actually...
Jack, we lost you for a minute. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, that the same people who were pledging all these efforts about the war just days before had refused to let cover President Bush's speech on television, with the exception of ABC. And this is...
We're having problems with Jack Beatty. We'll get that fixed. But Garen Daly, I mean, be serious. They're not going to put burkas on the gals of Baywatch.
No, they're not going to put the burkas on the gals, and they're not going to really change a lot of what they've done in the past. But one of the things that we have to understand is that American films are hugely popular in the world. Turkey is the number 19 market for Hollywood worldwide. You know, one of the biggest films playing right now in Lebanon is The Mummy Returns. People see these films, but I do think
don't come to them to see pilgrims reading from cookbooks.
No. I'm not talking about them. They're going to go out there and rejigger all the movies and turn it into like all these very propagandized. But I think what you're going to see is Hollywood is going to try and market themselves a little differently. And I think we're seeing that marketing change already in how they're marketing films in the United States.
Let's talk about some things coming up just this fall. We've got a clip here from Behind Enemy Lines. Do you want to tell us about what we're going to hear, or should we listen first?
I'm not sure the clip, so why don't we listen first and we can come back.
Let's listen. Here's the trailer for Behind Enemy Lines.
No! Our man is down behind enemy lines.
They killed my pilot because we took pictures of the graves and I know where they are. I'm going to get them.
You authorized the search and rescue. Private. Gully love.
I'm not going to let that kid die out there.
You will lose your command.
So be it. Gentlemen, any man who doesn't wish to join this mission, step away right now.
Evade and survive, and we will bring you home.
You still got your boots on you, cowboy?
They were tied on.
Behind Enemy Lines, obviously, with Gene Hackman, also Owen Wilson, the director's John Moore. Its release date, Garen Daly, was moved up to catch the war wave, was it not?
That's right. And here's what happened. They test screened this film on September 6th. September 6th. And the response was mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
They tested it a month later, and all of a sudden it was favorable. They tested it 2 weeks later, and all of a sudden it's, we need to see this film now. That's when they realized that there was a significant shift in how America was responding to the 9/11 tragedy. And that's when they decided to do it. And this film grossed $19 million in its opening weekend. If this opened in April as it was originally planned, you would not see that kind of gross.
What's the premise of the film? What's the story in a nutshell?
The premise is that there are some pilots flying over Serbia, taking some pictures, and they see a mass grave. The people who did the mass grave killings shoot the plane down. Pilots are stranded behind enemy lines, supposedly based on a true story. Admiral played by Gene Hackman does everything he can to save his guys.
So it's war. It's we will not let down our guys. It's in one of these ambiguous situations, in this case in the Balkans.
That's right.
And I guess they're seeing the resonance of our men and women in uniform on the ground or above Afghanistan bringing up public interest in this kind of film?
It's not only that.
Opened last weekend, by the way.
It opened last weekend. He ended $19 million for the weekend. You know, there's something else that's beyond there, too. I think that as a nation, we like to see ourselves as underdogs. So seeing someone trapped behind enemy lines and feeling that thing that we were attacked viciously by the al-Qaeda, and now seeing a film that kind of responds to that, we are again responding to that film, responding to our own national trauma.
But the soundtrack that we heard there sounds like a good old traditional Hollywood boom boom.
Well, it is a good old traditional Hollywood boom boom. And like I said, if it wasn't this particular time, this film would not do as well. And the other thing is that this film was made way, way before 9/11. And that's one of the things we have to remember about films. It's a year, year and a half before they come out.
We'll talk about the lag time before the real sort of response to 9/11 shows up. We're talking about Hollywood's lineup of films coming out in the big year-end Hollywood film season. We're talking with Garen Daly. He's owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and our special coverage film analyst. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Should Hollywood be responding to the war on terrorism? Has 9/11 changed what you want to see on the silver screen? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the upcoming films, films coming out now for the end-of-year season, the Christmas season. It's always a big time for Hollywood. This year, there's a different flavor. There's a different spin about it. The White House has put a little bit of the arm on Hollywood to think about the way it presents America to the world and maybe to try and develop a positive narrative of the whole war on terrorism effort to support the White House's effort in that regard. How about it? Do you expect Hollywood will help the nation understand the changed world we're in? Or will it just be more Rambo? Which films are you looking forward to seeing this season? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Garen Daly. He's a movie analyst and critic, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. We heard a little bit of Behind Enemy Lines just before the break, but it's not the only military war film that's been rushed out to the market. There's another one, Black Hawk Down, the story out of Somalia, of course, where the U.S. Rangers got in such trouble, pretty gory circumstances. Let's listen to a little bit from Black Hawk Down.
You shouldn't have come here. This is our war. Not yours.
300,000 dead and counting. That's not a war, Mr. Ito. It's genocide.
These people, they have no food. We can either help, or we can sit back and watch the country destroy itself on CNN.
Rangers, Deltas, today we go.
Once that first bullet goes past your head, politics go right out the window.
RPG!
Surrounded by thousands of Somali militia. I need help now.
The trailer for Black Hawk Down, here it is, action, drama, war. The director's Ridley Scott. It will star Josh Hartnett, Woody Harrelson, Sam Shepard, Ewan McGregor. Premise goes right back to real history about the U.S. Army Rangers who were trapped on a street in Mogadishu in Somalia and suffered terrible losses there, losses that led to huge changes in American foreign policy. American thinking about intervention were a big black mark for the Clinton administration and kept us out of a lot of humanitarian settings for years to follow. Garen Daly, do you think that the American public is ready to see this kind of scene that may be eerily reminiscent of the very rough streets that they've seen in Afghanistan? I stood on that street in Mogadishu. That's rough territory. Looks a lot like what we're seeing today in Kandahar and Kabul. Is the public there for that?
Well, they think it is. And again, it's testing very well. And one of the other things that they're doing with this film is they're saying what we heard about that incident, which was, again, part of the Al-Qaeda network is shooting those helicopters down. But what they're saying is that story...
Allegedly. We don't know for sure, but the word is out it might have been.
Right. But and they're showing it like that in the movie. Mm-hmm. But they're turning this around. They're saying this is not a black mark in our history. This is something to be very proud of. We had heroes there, and that we had men going to great lengths to save their fellow soldiers. Leave no man behind. They're talking heroism here. The fact that the Department of Defense worked hand in hand with the filmmakers of this film indicates that they also feel that this is going to be a very strong film. Now, they have moved it up 3 months because they feel, first of all, the quality of the film is good, that it's going to get Academy Award nominations. And secondly, that they feel that the public really wants to see something like this right now.
Jack Beatty, you're back with us from Vermont?
I hope so.
Good. Yes, there you are. Jack, I hope you heard that trailer for Black Hawk Down. Here's the refurbishing of a really difficult and tragic day in U.S. military history into a moment of heroism. Not that there wasn't heroism on that day, but is this typical in wartime that Hollywood cooperates in making our military look the best it can be?
I think so. And, you know, this movie is about sacrifice and about, you could say, defeat. But some of the best war films are really about defeat. And one made during World War II, really one of the best war films, John Ford's They Were Expendable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's about film.
Yeah, it's about the PT boat men in the Philippines from the moment when the Japanese attacked on December 8, 1941, till the surrender of Corregidor Island in April of 1942. And early on in the movie, an admiral says to the PT boat captains, he says, you know, this is like a baseball game. And the manager has said to us, get up to the plate, take a few pitches, and lay down that sacrifice bunt. Mm. That's what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. And the whole movie is about laying down sacrifice bunts. It's about retreats. But really what it's about is victory in defeat. And it's that sort of plangent emotional quality that gives the movie, that makes it last. It's about what we all do even in our own lives. We get defeated, but we show things in our struggles that can redeem them. And that's what these PT boatmen show as they lay down this sacrifice bunt.
And in this case, in Black Hawk Down, a film not made knowing that 9/11 would happen, but rushed out to the market to take advantage and respond to the public interest in that theater now.
Right. And that's one of the things we're going to see about this Christmas period, because there's several other films that we need to take a look at as well. And the question is, how will the American public respond to these films? And in their response will dictate how Hollywood will respond.
Well, what are you anticipating, Garen? Do you think we really come to the cinema with different eyes today, or we just go to the movies for the same reasons we've always gone to the movies?
Well, we're going to the movies for the same reasons, but we have been changed. I mean, I can't think of anybody who has not been changed by September 11th. And in that change, how we view and how we see our arts and our images is how we're going to be dictating how things are going to happen in the future.
But what does it mean? In the two trailers we just heard, it's bombs dropping. It's the same kind of high-tension war drama that we're quite accustomed to. Do you think Americans are going to be more interested in new themes, or are they going to be more soul searching?
Well, I think we're going to go back.
Rev it up, baby.
I think we're going to go back to some of our traditional values. And a film that I am very keen on, that I liked a lot, and I think that if it does really well and strikes that resonant chord, we're going to see more of. And this is a film called The Majestic. Mm. It's directed by Frank Darabont, who did Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, and it stars Jim Carrey, a very subdued Jim Carrey, and it's a story about a writer who is in Hollywood, 1953. He's been named as one of the people who is a communist. He leaves town, gets in an accident, has amnesia, and wakes up in a small town, and they think he's a long-lost son from World War II.
So there's a veteran angle here.
There's a veteran angle here. There's being downtrodden. It's like the values of a small town versus being in Hollywood.
And Jim Carrey not in his comic role.
No, very subdued, very good.
Let's listen to a little bit.
I don't even know who I am.
It's Luke!
Just look at him.
Look at him!
Seeing you walk down the street was like seeing one of my own boys alive again.
This town gave 62 of its young men to the war, more than our share.
This boy over here, Congress awarded him the Medal of Honor for courage, saving the lives of 8 men without thought to himself. His name was Luke. He was my son.
That's who you are.
Best thing you can do is gently reintroduce the person to things that were once familiar.
Do you remember me?
No, but I'll sure try.
Trailer for The Majestic, starring Jim Carrey, directed and written by Frank Darabont, who did The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, as our guest Garen Daly said. We're talking about American films, Hollywood films, and a little bit beyond that in a moment. But what do you expect from Hollywood in this post-9/11 season? Do you think Hollywood will change? Which films are you looking forward to this season? Are you looking for more romance, for fantasy, for shoot-em-ups, even now, especially now? Tell us what you're interested in. We're looking at the films. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Garen Daly, what is it about The Majestic that attracts you to this film?
Well, first of all, it's very Frank Capra-esque. You're going to hear a lot about that. It has a lot of those traditional values. It's like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And in fact, there is a huge scene near the end of the film where it finally has gotten his memory back, and he's in front of this House of Un-American Activities. And he gives this really impassioned speech about what these soldiers died for. And that, you know, it is very patriotic and very stirring. And one of the things that I thought about this film was that I think one of the changes that we're going to see coming out of Hollywood is that we're going to recognize that we can no longer have the same stereotypical xenophobic stereotypes that we've had in the past. And that we haven't quite found what our metaphor is But when we find our metaphor of how we're going to tell the story of 9/11, then we'll find who our new villain is. And I don't think it's going to be your traditional bad Arab or your crazy Irishman or your Russian. I think it's going to change somehow. I'm not sure how it's going to be, but I see an indication of that in The Majestic. And if the film is successful and it does strike that resonant chord, I think that's something to look at.
Well, it's an interesting film because it's a subtle take on patriotism. Well, it's not just stand up and salute the flag. This is a film about the excesses of the Red Scare, the blacklist of the anti-communist hysteria at a certain point. That's a funny lens through which to come at patriotism, isn't it?
Well, think about it. When you're looking at the witch hunts of the McCarthy period, those are very one-dimensional and two-dimensional villains. Mm-hmm. You know, the commies were villains, and they were very easy to pick out. And it was a really easy target for someone like McCarthy and even Nixon to go after. Now I think we can no longer do it. The world is much more complicated. Mm-hmm. It's much grayer. I don't think we can look at two-dimensional stereotypes anymore.
Audiences are too sophisticated for that now?
We understand it. We understand it now.
And yet, are you so confident that we won't bring out the bad Arab stereotype as we get into films that inevitably, eventually, maybe 18 months from now, will respond specifically to 9/11?
You know, I don't think so. I really believe that one of the good things that it's going to come out of this horrible, horrible tragedy is that we as a nation are going to really grow up and see the world the way it is. And in our inherent goodness, which I think Americans and as most people have, we're going to rise up and really change, do some change things. Maybe I'm a bit too idealistic, but I feel that way.
Americans, what do you think? Should Hollywood be responding to the war on terrorism? Has 9/11 changed what you want to see on the silver screen? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mikey's on the line. Hi, Mikey.
Hi. I want to talk about the Royal Tenenbaums because I think that's going to be a great movie for post 9/11.
We can just barely hear you. Did you say the Royal Tenenbaums?
Yeah, the Royal Tenenbaums.
It's the new Wes Anderson film with Gene Hackman, Angelica Houston, Owen and Luke Wilson, Gwyneth Paltrow. It's a very funny, very dry, very wry film. It's very droll. I love it.
Have you seen it, Mike, or are you just anticipating it?
Oh, I'm just anticipating it. I think it's going to be a little childish, maybe, but good escapist, intelligent, but escapist fun.
At a time when we could use it. Thanks for your call. What about Garen Daly? This is the escapist, silly walking line of films. Are we in need of that fix?
You know, it's funny you say silly walking because this has a kind of a British sense to it. This is directed by Wes Anderson, who did Rushmore. This is a comic variation of Orson Welles' Magnificent Ambersons. Gene Hackman
okay.
and Angelica
well,
Houston
kind of echoes that.
Yeah. And Gene Hackman and Angelica Houston have a family of three geniuses, and they all have kind of hit bottom, and they now try to get themselves back together.
When's it coming out? Do you know off the top of your head?
It's opening up on the 21st in selected places, expanding on the 4th and 11th throughout the country.
And then that is not the only vein of fantasy that we're going to see. Very famously, we're looking forward to Lord of the Rings coming out. That's in a class by itself when it comes to fantasy stories,
and
I guess.
It's an amazing story film. I mean, it's just you cannot believe the detail that Peter Jackson has put into this film. It looks like the book. It is. People who know the book are not going to be disappointed when they see that book. And it's a great story of good and evil.
Of course, a lot of people do know that book. It's maybe is this the grown-ups Harry Potter?
It is, but I think that people are going to have to be patient with this film because the first film is only one part of a trilogy, and it does not have the normal hero's arc that you would see in a film like Star Wars.
Let's listen to a little.
I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish none of this had happened.
So do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us. There are other forces at work in this world, Frodo, besides the will of evil. Bilbo was meant to find the ring. In which case, you also were meant to have it. And that is an encouraging thought.
A clip from Lord of the Rings, coming out imminently, directed by Peter Jackson, mostly made in the United Kingdom, isn't that right?
Actually, it's made in New Zealand.
It's made in New Zealand,
yeah.
All right.
It opens on the 19th.
Oh, well, that's on the 19th, and that's dramatic scenery for you. Jack Beatty, here we've got Good and Evil, but set in the Never Never Land of this Tolkien fantasy tale.
Well, I must tell you that I have never felt the charm of this particular series of books, so it'll come as
news.
It'll come as news to me, and I look forward to seeing it.
There may be one. Yes, do you? Or might there be one empty seat in the back of the Cavernous Theater, Jack Beatty?
Yeah, and I was empty with Harry Potter too.
Okay, hold right there. We've got a caller who may be more enthused about this film than you. Sean is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Sean. Have you seen or are looking forward to Lord of the Rings?
Hi, how you doing?
Well,
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm highly anticipating it, and I think that in the context of this conversation, I thought that it was a very interesting clip that you played, because the point I was trying to make, I mean, I think this film, or this trilogy rather, is going to have it already has a very, very large core audience.
Of course.
The novels, as we know, Tolkien's work has a cult status, but I think that following the events of 9/11, I think this film is going to have even more of an undertone that's going to speak to people.
The Dark Lord, the Evil One, is there.
I mean, there's an element of it's a nice element of escapism and fantasy, but there's some base elements in Tolkien's work that deal with good and evil and darkness in the world and overcoming insurmountable odds and being living through dark times and things like that that I think will have a little bit more relevance than they would have if things didn't happen.
It is all there. Sean, thanks for your observation. You're breaking up a little bit, but Garen and Jack, I want to put this to you. Good and evil in American films. Have they been very present, these themes, in recent years? Might they come back now? Evil's sure been a big word out of the White House this season.
Oh, I think you're always going to have good and evil. The question is what the definition of evil is going to be. I mean, is it going to be, you know, the classic, stereotypical, you know, two-dimensional, or is it going to be something a little more, you know, full-bodied.
But we also got used to Hollywood embracing a kind of anything goes infatuation, sometimes with the evil one, with the bad guy. Do you think that may be put on a back burner now, Jack Beatty?
Well, that could be. Even some of the positive figures, superhero figures, have been kind of bad guys, and that they're the damage they do is just so great. Villains. The thing about evil in movies is it's hard to combine it with what makes for great art, which really is ambiguity and shadows and the dappled and the mixed. And this is what makes for great art. And good and evil, the Western and so on, these are parables. They're allegories. They're strong, but they often don't generate the greatest. Film art, which is art that involves all of us and not just our myth-making side, but our whole being, which is shot through with contradiction and ambiguity.
Maybe, Jack, that goes to Garen's optimism that we may see some nuanced filmmaking about 9/11 and its aftermath.
Well, that would be something. I mean, I take his point that I think that it's going to be very hard to do depictions of Arab terrorists or just because of the consciousness we have. And even Karl Rove brought this out at the meeting in Hollywood. You know, we don't want to denigrate Islam. So it's going to be perhaps they'll find a way through these allegorical movies to touch on evil figures who won't be in headdress, but who will have the same a sort of M.O. as Osama bin Laden, which is a kind of almost motiveless malignity.
We're talking about Hollywood going into the big film season. Do you expect Hollywood will help the nation understand the changed world we're in, or will it just be more Rambo? Which films are you looking forward to this season? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about films as we head into the big movie season. We're going to look away from Hollywood for just a second to look at a foreign film, a docudrama called Kandahar, of all things, the Taliban stronghold that just fell today, and also the name of a film
that is based on the story of a young female journalist who escapes Afghanistan to Canada. In this fictionalized retelling of events in her life, she returns to her native Afghanistan, disguising her identity to save her sister, who is bent on committing suicide because things are just so bad. Here, a clip from Kandahar.
Here near the Afghan border, young girls who are about to return to Afghanistan are being taught about the dangers of landmines. I am glad you don't know the truth that in Afghanistan these past 20 years, one human being has died every 5 minutes from mines, from war, famine or drought. If you knew that, you would have lost hope every 5 minutes and would have wanted to kill yourself.
The camp supervisor have gathered all returning families to take their pictures, and I can choose a family to go with them as the third or fourth wife. More than men, I am worried about their women and their reaction to my presence. But unfortunately, they're all under full cover and I can't see their faces to know how they feel about me.
An excerpt from Kandahar, directed by Mohsen Makhmalbaf. Garen Daly, what can you tell us about this film? This is not your Hollywood blockbuster format. It's coming out December 14th, by the way. But this is a more artistic approach to a nuanced approach to a very real social problem and crisis of women in Afghanistan.
Yeah, the first thing is this is a very lucky film. I mean, you have to take a look at it. It's got a great title. It's very timely. It's politically correct because it deals with a woman in a country that is being where women have been downtrodden and abused.
More right out of the headlines.
Really. So it's extremely lucky that it came out this time. And this happens every once in a while where, for whatever reason, a story being told just hits the consciousness of the world. And that's what this film is. And it gets us, it's going to give us a really personal look at what it's like to be a woman in an oppressive society.
Something a lot of people, especially in the Afghan context, really want to understand right now.
Yeah, I think we all need to understand it because, you know, if we're never going to really understand how it happened, we need to understand what happened.
Kandahar, coming out December 14th. We're talking about films in Hollywood. You can join the conversation. Should Hollywood be responding to the war on terrorism, or is that not what you want from our magical mystery industry? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Peter's on the line. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I want to express a general concern about just the fact that the president's man was at a meeting with Hollywood as if telling them what sort of movies the American people should see, not so much as if movies being made to make us support the war effort.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Peter. And if you look at the list of things that Karl Rove raised, I mean, they're really not subtle. He said that the White House would like it to be stressed that the war is against terrorism, not Islam, that Americans must be called to national service, that Americans should support the troops, that this is a global war that needs a global response, that this is a war against evil, that American children have to be reassured, and that instead of propaganda, the war effort needs a narrative that should be told with accuracy and honesty. But it's a real civil engineering project being described here, Garen Daly.
It's no different than what Franklin Roosevelt was asking of Hollywood in 1941 and 1942. And, you know, the other thing is as Jack pointed out, you know, Hollywood is only going to do those things which they feel that they can make money at. They're not going to do this for altruistic purposes. I mean, they'll do their part. They'll pitch in and do whatever. But if they're losing money, you can rest assured that those studio heads have people that they have to answer to, and it'll shift quickly if they're losing money at it.
Jack Beatty, we've had a technical problems. Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. You've got a couple of World War II films up your sleeve that look at how war is addressed during and after, and maybe as kind of heads up to how we see this war on terrorism portrayed now and later. Thoughts there?
Yeah, well, I mentioned They Were Expendable, which was made just at the end of the war. But I think one of the best World War II movies made, I think, in 1948 is 12 O'Clock High. And it's about the bombing pilots over Germany.
Which became really a TV show, too.
That's right. Yeah. And it's really, there's very little action in it. And it's really about the psychiatric front and you know, which is a part of war that doesn't make it's hard to glamorize that. In fact, it can't be glamorized. And yet, in terms of casualties, this is the dimension where more casualties are made in war than any other. And in it, the general in charge, played by Gregory Peck, is trying to sort of realize a life, an activity of what he called maximum effort. And we ask soldiers to have maximum effort. And, of course, maximum effort is often not consistent with mental health and with emotional health. And this movie really shows a man, a strong man, deteriorating under the pressures of maximum effort. And as one thinks of it, one, you know, thinks of our own aviators now and people on the ground, that this part of war lingers many, many years after the damage is done.
Well, while we go to the movies, there have been a lot of sorties flown and a lot of bombs dropped over Afghanistan.
Yeah. Of course, not against a sea of flak and fighters, as the people who bombed Germany did.
Yeah,
67,000 American.
Yeah, nothing like the same.
That's
right,
same.
And not the number of casualties that, you know, when you're looking at the, you know, flights going up, battalions going out, flying into Germany, coming back with 30% losses, 40% losses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 67,000 flyers died in the war.
And now we mourn inappropriately, but numbers that are in the single digits.
Yes.
Yeah, what an amazing change in what war requires. Interesting to see how Hollywood deals with that because, of course, the threat, the imminence of sacrifice is part of what makes war movies compelling.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that we didn't really talk about was the lag time between when films start and when they come out.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are saying that the reason that we're starting to see a lot of war films, because there's a bunch more coming up. There's Charlotte Gray, there's Enigma, there is the new Bruce Willis film called Hearts War, a new Mel Gibson film from about Vietnam, We Were Soldiers. These are all spawned by the success of Saving Private Ryan. So that's the lag time. That's the length. It's a year and a half, 2 years.
That lets
sometime.
You know how long it will be until we really see things coming out
right.
of the war in Afghanistan.
And right now in Hollywood, there's a real glut of films for a variety of reasons, mainly because of the writer's strike and the actor's strike that didn't happen last summer. They made all these films right away and stockpiled them. So we're going to see a lot of films through the first part of 2002. Then we'll start seeing some of the stuff post 9/11 and the fall of 2002.
But you look at that amazing cinematic scenes in the still photography coming out of Afghanistan every day, and talk about a setting that calls out for some great David Lean-style director to get in there and make a huge sweeping film. It must be calling out to them right now.
Or a small personal film. I would like to see some
small
film. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up was a thing called genre displacement. And what is that?
Your terms.
I am going to define my term. That is that for whatever reason, we as a nation do not want to see a particular film. So we have a film that kind of alludes to it. Perfect example would be during Vietnam. We saw Vietnam every night on our TV. Mm-hmm. We did not want to see a Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up seeing films like The Wild Bunch, a bloody, bloody Western. So it kind of displaced our desire.
Sublimated into another setting.
That's right.
Could happen again. It's Pearl Harbor Day. We've got to just get one mention there. The DVD is coming out?
The DVD is out, and I got to tell you, this is the worst of Hollywood because it's crass, and it just capitalizes on it, and I didn't like it. I liked the movie okay, but I did not like the DVD at all.
Well, we won't rush out for that. Garen Daly, special coverage movie analyst and critic, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Enjoy yourself at the movies. Jack Beatty, stand by. We're going to listen to some sounds of this last week in the news.
A day when the Middle East conflict took a distinct turn. A day when talk of war became the common currency.
This will not be an easy war. This war will not be a short war. But we shall win.
We found a person who says he's an American with an AK-47 in a prison with a bunch of Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters. He was going to be certain.
Along with all the rest of America, grieve for the loss of life in Afghanistan. Three of our soldiers were killed by an inadvertent bomb. And
if ever there were proof of the existence of evil in the world, it is in the pages of these reports. Terrorist operatives infiltrate our communities, plotting, planning, waiting to kill again.
Kandahar was the birthplace of the Taliban, and it was here that many expected a last and violent stand. Only last week, amid these ruins, the talk was of fighting to the death. No longer. The regime is surrendering, and this evening in London, the Prime Minister felt able to declare that the strategy was working.
Just as we were 60 years ago, in a time of war, this great nation will be patient, will be determined, and we will be relentless in the pursuit of freedom.
Sounds from a week more of war, a week in which Kandahar, the last stronghold of the Taliban, fell. Jack Beatty, what are you thinking at the end of this week? Is the war over or just a chapter change? Where are we here?
Well, it's kind of an equivocal triumph. Yes, Kandahar has fallen and the board has been swept clean of the Taliban. But Mullah Omar has disappeared. The people with him, armed, have disappeared. And Osama bin Laden remains at large. Mm-hmm. And rumors quoted an Afghan intelligence officer, I think, quoted today, saying that he thinks that he's probably already slipped across the border. He's poised on that border. Mm-hmm. to Pakistan. So
around the famous Tora Bora.
Yeah, we have yet to bring Mullah Omar or bin Laden to justice, and that may be a bridge too far. We'll just have to see.
Well, of course, that is etched in the agenda, though, and it's not going to go away. So those searches will go on. But I wonder about the larger momentum of President Bush's war on terrorism. Afghanistan went much faster than many people expected. They've achieved this piece of it. They've got the country up on its toes and in a mood to do the necessary. I wonder if there won't be a temptation in Washington to somehow keep it rolling, as Bush has already suggested they may, not to lose that public support, that groundswell.
Yeah.
Watch out, Iraq, I guess.
Watch out, Iraq. Yeah, and Sudan and other places. But I'm beginning to think that he said that as much as a bluff to Saddam. In other words, if we want to get inspectors in there to look at his weapons of mass destruction. This momentum can really play a country false. The Japanese, succumbed to it in World War II. They just mm-hmm. thought they were on a roll. Mm-hmm. They just were going to have one thing was going to follow another, and they just overextended themselves. They overplayed this feeling of, and we don't want to get into that overplaying of our hand with an invasion of Iraq or a campaign against Iraq at a time when the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is so inflamed.
Jack, I'm sorry. I just wanted to note, because we've just got a minute, but the casualties of this war, once again, were very small for American soldiers, but we did have friendly fire casualties this week from a very large bomb, almost hit Hamid Karzai, the interim president, but that's where the death came.
It did, and it came to Americans, and it came to Afghans. Mm-hmm. There was two images from the week stick in my mind. One is of I think, 11-year-old boy in a hospital in Jalalabad who had been hit by friendly fire. Mm-hmm. His eyes were missing. His mm-hmm. hands were missing. And he was talking to his uncle, and at a certain point he said, "It hurts to talk." And then at the other end of the country, around Kandahar, three Americans were killed by friendly fire. One of them, Sergeant Prosser, we get a glimpse of his character in this depiction by Sarah Reimer in the New York Times. That his coach said that when he was the captain, he would frequently separate his shoulder instead of leaving the game. Mm. His coach said his player would go to the sidelines and ask his father to pop his shoulder back into place so he could keep playing. So we see a sense of his character. And then another gentleman from Massachusetts, Sergeant Pethery, cabled his brother, emailed just last week when his brother said, "I want you to be gung-ho over there." He emailed him back, "Will do."
And up to a point, he did. We will remember them.
Indeed.
Jack, thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Special coverage listeners, for an upcoming show, we want to know about the music you've turned to since the events of September 11th for strength, for hope, or to grieve. Has it been the American music of Aaron Copland, the blues of Billie Holiday, the modernism of Philip Glass, or straight pop? Send your ideas by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.